It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last week, House Republicans passed a major budget bill that would make sweeping changes to tax revenue and spending in the federal government.
The changes include funding cuts and new eligibility requirements for federal programs like food assistance and Medicaid. The bill would also eliminate taxes on cash tips and overtime pay and increase the national debt ceiling.
The legislation passed by just one vote. Now it's in the Senate's hands. Because of the process that's being used, it can pass without Democratic votes, but it is expected to face opposition, even from Senate Republicans like Ron Johnson.
I talked yesterday with Republican U.S. Representative Brian Steil, who represents Wisconsin's first congressional district, including Janesville, Racine, and Kenosha. Briefly, big picture, what elements of this big bill would make the most significant changes for Wisconsinites?
It continues to build on President Trump's success in securing the U.S.-Mexico border. That's essential. It invests in the United States military at a period of time where we face challenges around the globe. And it does that while saving money at a period of time when our federal government is spending beyond its means. And the most important piece is probably making sure that there's not a tax increase on the American people, giving an opportunity for further growth in our economy, which means good and better paying jobs for people across the state of Wisconsin.
Now, in the House, this was a tightly negotiated bill. Were there things you had hoped for that didn't get in there or that you hoped against and did get in there?
Well, you know, at any time when you have a narrowly divided majority and it's difficult to get anything done in Washington, you know, no bill is absolutely perfect. But I do believe the final text of the bill moves us in the right direction. I think we're going to have to continue to look at additional savings to make sure that we get our spending under control. But this bill, as drafted, is unquestionably a step in the right direction.
It's on to the Senate now, and Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson has been critical of the bill. He told Jake Tapper on CNN that it doesn't do enough to reduce the deficit. Here is a listen.
And I'm sorry, the House bill would probably add, I've calculated $4 trillion. You're saying you have these independent analysts saying it's $3.3 to $4 trillion. I agree with that. We have to reduce the deficit, and so we need to focus on spending.
Senator Johnson saying, hey, this does too much to increase the deficit. What do you say?
Well, I would agree that I think we have a broader and further opportunity to continue our work to get spending under control. That said, I do believe this bill is a step in the right direction. It doesn't accomplish as much as many of us want, but that's sometimes how the negotiations play out. And so we'll see how the Senate amends and adjusts this bill before we'll ultimately get a second vote on it prior to it becoming law.
Another point of criticism, this coming from Democrats. I talked to your Wisconsin Democratic colleague, Gwen Moore from Milwaukee, yesterday. She made the case that, hey, the big deficit booster is extending those 2017 tax cuts. That's where the big jump, she sees it in the deficit coming. What do you say to that angle of criticism?
Well, I think as we look at the tax provisions, what we really see is a continuation of the tax policy that was set in place in 2017. And so when the Democrats had full control, they decided not to alter the tax policy. And what we're doing is really doubling down on that and continuing on not putting forward a tax increase on the American people. Sometimes the accountants and the actuaries will tell you it does X, Y, or Z on the revenue side. But the bottom line is the overwhelming majority of this bill is making sure that we continue the tax rates as they are and we don't increase them on hardworking families.
Representative Moore also pointed toward the Congressional Budget Office read on this, looking at the distributional impact of the whole package, saying, hey, you look at the top 10% of earners in America, they benefit in the percentage of the income they gain. You look at the bottom 10%, they get hit, including by social safety net programs they'll get into. That big picture, I assume come election time, the attack for Democrats will be, hey, this was a giveaway to the rich at the expense of the poor. Your response to that?
Yeah, it's nothing new to hear class warfare arguments coming from the left at a period of time. We're trying to grow the economy. And this bill has increases of deductions for seniors up to $75,000. And so making sure that we're focused in on hardworking families is the ultimate goal. And I think what we saw, if we look back when these tax policies were originally put in place, in 2017 was significant growth in the economy, in particular, real wages rising, in particular for the least amongst us. We saw actually high wage growth, in particular for Blacks, for Hispanics, for Asians, women, and veterans, above the median. That's all positive. And so doubling down on these tax policies and making sure that we are allowing individuals to see their real wages rise is the end result that I think we'll see when these tax policies are put into place.
Talking to Republican U.S. Representative Brian Stile from Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District about the budget bill now headed to the Senate. Medicaid, a big point of contention, including among some Republicans in the Senate. Some cuts coming, likely removing some people from Medicaid, including Badger Care Plus here in Wisconsin. What do you think of what came out of this bill when it comes to Medicaid and how it could impact Wisconsin?
There's a lot of fear-mongering on this topic, and so I think it's important to drill down as to what changes were made. What changes were made was primarily putting in place work requirements for able-bodied, childless adults of working age, saying that if you are on the state-funded or the state and federal-funded program, we want to make sure that you're working or looking for work in a process to earn benefits. That's not true, of course, where we're strengthening the program for the program that was originally designed for children, pregnant women, permanently disabled adults. There's no changes for those groups. What there are changes in making sure that we're helping lift people up and into good and better paying jobs and into self-sustainability. And so far too often we analyze our social safety net programs simply by their inputs, how much money we're spending. I'm of the belief we should be measuring them also by their outputs. How are we doing in helping people live out a healthy life? And I think these work requirements actually move us in the right direction, making sure we're protecting the program for those it's truly designed for.
There have been some arguments that things like work requirements, more regular re-sign-up requirements, things like that, could effectively push people off by red tape. Hey, maybe they should be entitled to the program as it stands, but because there are more hoops to jump through, they slip through the cracks. Is that a concern?
I think what we have is a real opportunity to make sure that we don't allow that to occur, that we strengthen the safety net program for those it's truly designed for. And so for individuals that it's not designed for, individuals that will choose to go and get a job, in particular jobs that have good private sector health insurance, we should be celebrating that. And so I think we can always make sure we're strengthening the program. It's a state-run, federally funded or federally funded shared program. And so there's going to be an onus on the state to make sure we get it right. We do the same thing in many other programs, including, for example, unemployment insurance. And so the state has to make sure that we're getting this right. That's true. But I'm of the belief that we're capable of doing that within the modern technological age.
We've heard from some rural hospitals around Wisconsin saying they're worried, is this going to hit their Medicaid reimbursement rates? Some of them are already struggling to stay open, also pointing toward some Medicare grants that have been stopped, at least temporarily, by the Trump administration. Your thoughts on the state of rural hospitals and what federal policy can do to help or hurt them?
We need to make sure that we're strengthening our rural hospitals. We've had challenges in the state of Wisconsin and some of our more rural areas where hospital access is a unique challenge. The bill that passed through the House does not alter the FMAP. It doesn't alter that reimbursement rate that was discussed from different parties for different reasons. Some people wanted to increase it, some decrease it. At the end of the day, the FMAP did not change. But the bottom line is we need to remain focused on making sure that we're having strong rural hospitals across the state of Wisconsin so that everyone has access to good quality health care.
Wisconsin, the state government here in a budget cycle right now, looking at things like SNAP, the food assistance program in particular, maybe some Medicaid concerns at the state level that some of these costs are going to get offloaded to the state that are now currently handled by the feds. What would you say to Wisconsin policymakers?
At the end of the day, nationally, by having a fully federally funded program, a lot of states began to very poorly manage the SNAP program. This is all about strengthening the programs for those that it's truly designed for. And so a 5% cost shift from the federal government to the states, what that does is have states have some skin in the game. Wisconsin on the whole does a reasonably good job. Our error rate is reasonably low, although there's still room for improvement to make sure that the federal government or taxpayer dollars writ large are not being unnecessarily spent. And so the question here is, how do we get states to truly have some skin in the game, to make sure that they're running the checks, to make sure that people aren't abusing the program? Some states have been really egregious in this regard. And so making sure that all states have a little bit of skin in the game, I think will actually, at the end of the day, strengthen the program for those that it's truly designed for.
Now, the bill is in the Senate. We have Senator Johnson from Wisconsin saying he may have enough Senate votes to block this and demand further spending cuts. Senator Josh Hawley, another Republican, before the final version of your House bill came out, said, hey, don't do too much Medicaid cutting. I'm going to be watching that closely. This faces a rocky road in the Senate. For you, if it comes back to you in this reconciliation process, you're voting on it, what kind of change is too much change for you to still support a bill when it comes back from the Senate?
Well, we'll see how the Senate ultimately moves forward on the bill. I've talked to a number of our Senate colleagues about what they would like to see. I do believe that we have to continue to work to make sure that we're getting spending under control. Again, this bill doesn't accomplish 100% of everything we need to do to get spending under control. That said, it's unquestionably a step in the right direction. So we'll continue to watch how the Senate amends this bill, and we'll look for that final product and make an assessment when it's finally passed in the Senate.
And finally, this bill we're talking about, it's taken a lot of the oxygen in the room. Are there other priorities on your agenda that you're hoping to advance now that this thing has been handed over to the Senate?
You know, there's a number of things that is on our plate from our National Defense Reauthorization Act, which is our defense policy bills. The Farm Bill is a continuation of work that we need to make sure we get right for our farmers. And in particular, in my space, I'm uniquely working to make sure that we get legislation and digital assets to make sure we're doing two things, protecting consumers, but also making sure that the United States can outcompete the rest of the world, and including China, as we enter kind of the Web3 age.
Representative Style, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
That was Republican U.S. Representative Brian Style, who represents Wisconsin's 1st congressional district. That includes Janesville, Racine, and Kenosha. I talked to him yesterday about the federal budget bill that passed the House last week.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a new book shows how Midwestern farmers fed the world and transformed agriculture starting in the Cold War.
Midwesterners were actually much more engaged. They saw their work, particularly as farmers, as essential to building a world that came after.
The author of Global Heartland, that's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Over a century ago, Wisconsin's agriculture department said that farmers in this state were producing unprecedented yields, more oats than any other state, and enough wheat and rye to be completely self-sufficient.
Midwestern farms were thriving. World War I patriotism was surging, and this dynamic created a new relationship between farmers, the government, and the world.
A new book makes the case that Midwestern farmers were not bystanders to the rise of America as a world superpower, but a key to its ascent in the 1900s, transforming Wisconsin's farmland in the process.
Peter Simons is a historian and lecturer at Hamilton College in New York. His new book is called Global Heartland, Cultivating the American Century on the Midwestern Farm. Peter, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to talk with you today.
You take us through example after example of how Wisconsin and upper Midwest farmers like move away from isolationism toward globalization and the use of agriculture as part of these global relationships during and after the wars. Why is it important to highlight this chapter of American history?
It's important in part because there was this tension right at the beginning of World War II, where you find these two different camps, one mostly Americans who are living outside the Midwest, who are, I think, genuinely frightened that the Midwest is going to be the downfall of the United States as it begins fighting fascism overseas. And then you have this population of Midwesterners who are telling the opposite story, that they actually see the Midwest as being essential to whatever comes after World War II. And so there had long been this idea of Midwestern isolationism. And there's been a long-running feud about how genuine was that. And so you can trace that going back. And there's this surprising discovery that Midwesterners were actually much more engaged, and not even just engaged in creating this global world. They were, you know, they weren't just accepting what others were serving up, but they saw their work, particularly as farmers, as essential to building a world that came after. And so this question of why did they see themselves in this way was the genesis of this book, trying to answer how exactly did that come to be, and what does that mean about the way we understand the United States and its position in the world still today?
Still today, how does this lens on Midwestern farmers inform how we look at geopolitics now? What do you think?
I obviously had no expectation when I had begun writing this book that it would be published into the sort of global circumstances that we now find ourselves that it's been published into. And so it is kind of an amazing thing, because the story talks about how the relationship between these farmers and the rest of the world becomes so essential to the work that they're doing that you really can't imagine anything else by the 1950s. And so to find ourselves in this world today where it's actually sort of reviving this mythology that Americans want to cut off their ties to the rest of the world. And of course, we've seen with current trade policy that there very quickly was a carve out made for farmers, because they do rely so heavily on the people who are eating American food abroad. It's obviously a bit different story now than it was in the 1940s and 1950s when I'm looking, but this thing had become so entrenched in American agriculture, and to at least ostensibly end that, you know, we'll see what actually ends up happening a year down the road, but is really reversing 60 or 70 years of American agricultural policy, American foreign policy, and really the fundamental sense of Americans and how they relate to the rest of the world.
And how Midwestern farmers were stepping up. I was astounded. Wisconsin's agricultural production skyrocketed in 1918 after the Great War, with Wisconsin producing the most oats in the nation, more corn than it had ever grown, enough wheat and rye to make the state self-sustaining. I just paused there, and I'm just wondering, what increased our state's output this much?
There are a number of different factors, but the most basic one is that it turned out to be incredibly profitable during the war, because there was an incredible demand for these products. And so farmers would divert other crops into these that were most needed overseas and start growing more than they ever had before. But the other thing that happens is agricultural technology, like tractors, had been in development for quite some time leading up until World War I, but with the sudden loss of farmhands, family members, whoever, who was going either to fight abroad or they were going to factories to make the weapons that were going to be used abroad, there's a shortfall in agricultural labor. And so the very rapid adoption of these technologies helped create higher yields than states like Wisconsin had ever seen before. Of course, because they're building tanks and all trucks and all these other things that they need for war, there's not enough material to actually build all the tractors that are needed. So the state agricultural departments will send out bulletins telling you how to try to craft your own tractor or create your own plow that will hold you over until the war is done and you can actually buy proper equipment for your field. So this is a moment where we see a really intensified adoption of agricultural technology.
Peter, you trace the Lend-Lease Act. In 1941, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt formalized aid to Britain months before America formally enters World War II through the Lend-Lease Act. What was the Lend-Lease Act, and how did it lead to growth in America's agricultural exports?
The way that we usually understand Lend-Lease is through arming America's allies overseas. So sending airplanes, sending weapons to, most notably, Great Britain. The idea being that if we can give them the material that they need to fight the war against Germany, maybe the United States won't have to send their own troops, that this will sort of hold the Germans at bay and they'll win the war eventually. But what was interesting to me is the announcement of the Lend-Lease Act is in part made at a Farm Bureau Federation meeting in Washington, D.C. Lord Lothian, who's the British ambassador to the United States, is there as part of this announcement. He tragically dies the next day, but it goes to show that agriculture was foremost in the minds of Roosevelt and his cabinet as they were crafting the Lend-Lease Act. All of these other wartime materials were essential, but you couldn't have the war without all of this food. And so what it does is it immediately pulls American farmers into the war far before factories start filling with people who are building bombers and munitions and all these other things. And of course, the farmers don't have any choice because it's just sort of built into the market. The government is buying their farm products. They're not setting aside anything specially. And so the farmers are, in a way, the first American contributors to World War II. They're very skeptical at first because there is a sharp memory of World War I. And there's common knowledge that you have a recession after every war. And so war, for obvious reasons, you don't want a war, but especially for economic reasons, you don't want a war. But as Lend-Lease continues to go, farmers are starting to notice that they're enjoying better rates of return on their crops than they ever had in recent history, that there's suddenly a sustained market that they hadn't known since the 19-teens. And they're starting to see the benefit of supplying overseas consumers, even if it might be in wartime, that they're, that trade is becoming ever more essential to their own livelihood.
Mm-hmm. Dairy farmers in particular were skeptical, and dairy was labeled a victory food by Wisconsin dairy leaders during World War I. What was happening in dairy?
This is a turning point for dairy in the United States. Nutritional science is very new at this point, and so there's a greater understanding that there's a full gamut of nutrients that milk offers that many other foods don't. And so this becomes, in part, a marketing scheme, but also realization that people who desperately need food can really benefit from having milk. Of course, there's a geographical boundary on how far you can take a canister of milk. And so that had always limited dairy sheds. If you are in Wisconsin, you're probably not sending your milk to New York, but you are to Chicago, maybe to Minneapolis. There are these new technologies. Once again, technology becomes key here to, for example, dry milk so that it can be sent abroad without the water. It's reconstituted and then can be consumed as milk overseas. With these technologies, which the federal government builds and then allows companies like Kraft to operate, allows for this explosion in the quantities of milk that can be shipped over much greater distances than they ever could before. And then at the end of the war, the federal government sells these facilities to these companies for usually a dollar, and they have these enormous new facilities that they can use to continue selling Midwestern dairy goods to consumers who had never been able to get them before.
We're talking about a new book exploring the power of Midwestern farming in World War II and beyond with Peter Simons, historian and author of Global Heartland. Peter, at the end of World War II, Wisconsin counted nearly 9,000 fewer farms between 1940 and 45. And you conclude that the Midwest agricultural countryside emerges from the war with fewer people who live on bigger farms and produce more food. And I'm wondering, how does that compare to our rural areas now and how our farming communities in Wisconsin are becoming larger and larger with these, you know, mechanized farms? Is this a continuation of what was happening in those times?
Yeah, it is a continuation of the intensification of agriculture. Part of what happens in the war is that there is a draft. And although the military draft is very lenient for farmers, mostly because they have a lot of friends in Congress, a growing number of farmhands, sons, daughters, go off to serve in the military. Others move to cities to much better pay than they had before. And if you read small town newspapers, agricultural newspapers, there will be this lament about the loss of all of these people who had grown up on farms and a despair whether they're going to come back again. So there's this focus on, we need to build a new hospital. We need to build an airport. We need all of these modern conveniences to attract these people who had been on farms back. Well, of course, they mostly don't come back. Part of the GI plan is that you could go to college or you could get a farm. And initially, the USDA is concerned that so many people are going to want their own farm when they come back from fighting overseas. And that just doesn't turn out to be the case. Very few people actually want to use government programs to purchase farms. People are much happier being elsewhere. And so by necessity, to continue producing the amount of food that is being demanded, the people who are left buy up these farms that are left. They, of course, have access to greater amounts of machinery. And so a single farmer can produce far more than they ever can. And this just continues on and on. And of course, following World War II, then we have a further chemical revolution. We have hybrid seeds that had been available but become intensified as well. So there are all these inputs that change and make it possible to produce food with far fewer people than ever before.
Women farmers also were increasing as well. Besides the farm machinery, you also saw women on the farm and their labor and responsibilities, especially during World War II. Can you describe what you were seeing there?
The role of women on farms is a hotly debated one at the time. And it even maps geographically that there are particular parts of the country where there's enormous resistance to welcoming women. I should make a distinction here. There's an acceptance of women who live on farms. So what the USDA would identify as farm wives, which is a tricky term, right? Because the women are just as much farmers, but they're never actually identified as farmers. They're mm-hmm. identified as farm wives or their daughters. And so there's this sense of sort of a natural born instinct in what it takes to understand the land, to understand livestock. And so farmers are willing to give greater responsibility to women who are already on farms. But there are all of these other programs, for example, the Women's Land Army, that will recruit women who mostly live in urban places. Many of them are college students. They will spend the summer on a farm and then go back to school once the term starts in fall. And there's an enormous amount of resistance initially to this. Eventually, because the need is so desperate, there's increased acceptance. But there's certainly a very gendered notion of what's appropriate for a woman to do on a farm, because the farmers are much more willing to accept male farmers from outside the United States, for example, than they are women who are coming from a college campus to spend, say, 2 months on their farm. There's always skepticism of the relationship that they have to agriculture.
Let's land on tariffs, because the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act from 1930 leaps from your pages now, considering sure. the times we're in. I mean, modern debates around tariffs seem to really echo, it seems, arguments made you know, about a century ago around issues like protecting domestic production. So what lessons can we learn from the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act that might be relevant to American farming today?
There is an intense debate between Henry Wallace, who then is Secretary of Agriculture, and someone named George Peek, who's often also in the USDA, about the best path forward for American agriculture. Is this something in which we benefit by engaging the rest of the world, or do we need to focus on the United States instead? There's the American Dairy Association has no interest in the 1940s in prolonging the shipments of dairy overseas. They just want to convince Americans that they should consume more dairy than they do right now. So they look to Scandinavia in particular, and they say, look at how much milk Scandinavians drink and look how much cheese they eat. We need to convince Americans to do the same. Well, obviously, this turns out to be a non-starter because American goods continue to go overseas. Now, the American farm economy is, of course, one in which there is an incredible amount of intervention to make American farming operate the way it does today. So I don't want to make any sort of pitch for some sort of mythological version of a market that without barriers that benefits American farmers. But at least I can say that in the past, it has proven that finding overseas markets has been one of the prime drivers of benefits to American farmers.
Peter, thank you for your book. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was lovely to speak with you.
That is historian Peter Simons, author of the new book, Global Heartland, Cultivating the American Century on the Midwestern Farm.
Coming up, women's basketball is getting more popular. A longtime Wisconsin coach hopes that can bring more girls into the sport after years of declining numbers at the high school level.
We've had some struggles having enough players for three high school teams to get a freshman team and a JV and a varsity team.
The future of girls basketball in Wisconsin next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Springtime in the Midwest means mushroom hunters head to the woods, and they're typically looking for morels.
But as Harvest Public Media's Kate Grumpier reports, there are also Midwesterners who are working on finding a way to farm the elusive mushroom.
Inside the grow room at Mushrooms Naturally in O'Fallon, Missouri, it's always spring, or at least something like spring.
So lots of light, fresh air, and humidity, which basically recreates their ideal time of year for all of the varieties that we grow.
Owner JT Gelino shows off shelves with logs covered in mushrooms that will soon be for sale.
So we have maitake, or our hen of the woods mushrooms. And then we have our king oyster mushrooms. We've got some shiitake mushrooms.
But one of the most iconic and lucrative Midwestern mushrooms can't be found in this room, the morel. Instead, Gelino heads into a wooded area behind his farm, crossing a small creek and ducking under honeysuckle. Morels are a stemmed mushroom with a pitted, pointed cap. There are a lot of lookalikes out here. Walnut shells and limestone rocks, even leaves.
All of these things initially have that kind of honeycomb appearance that, if they're the right color, will really catch your eye.
Eventually, he finds what he's looking for.
Oh, here's one. See? Now look at this. This is the smallest one I've found yet.
A tiny morel mushroom, the size of Gelino's thumbnail. mushrooms are getting more and more popular. And specialty mushroom farms like Jelinos are a growing trend in the U.S. Connor Youngerman is an extension support specialist at the Cornell Small Farms Program.
Overall, mushroom production is increasing. Mushroom farmers, there are more and more of them.
But North America's wild morels have a life cycle that has proven tricky to replicate in a farm setting.
Morels are a mysterious and romantic and strange mushroom.
Still, some are trying. Wisconsin-based Field and Forest Products sells mushroom spawn and supplies to farmers and home growers. Lindsay Bender is Field and Forest's chief mycologist and research director. For about the past 5 years, the company has been selling morel spawn. But Bender says they can't guarantee customers will be successful.
We still call it a bag of hope in that we can guarantee that it's good spawn that you're receiving, but you know, the mystery of actually getting that to produce and successfully produce is still the challenge.
In China, farmers are successfully growing large amounts of black morels. And a Michigan state-led study found farmers could reliably grow morels in 5 Midwestern states. But the problem was profit. They didn't grow enough to make money. Field and Forest Spender thinks in the next few years, the Midwest will catch up.
So there are certainly some limitations to maybe the sustainability of the industry. But I think in terms of developing a more dependable method and culture, I think we're pretty close to that.
Even if Midwesterners could reliably farm the mushroom, many foragers would still head out to the woods. Nebraskan Tersh Kepler has been hunting morels for almost 60 years. He doesn't want to see the mushroom grown commercially.
I honestly don't think they're ever going to figure that one out, at least hopefully not in my lifetime. It's an adult Easter egg hunt is what it's like. I don't want that to ever change.
For Kepler and many other Midwesterners, this is a tradition that commercial cultivation won't end. I'm Kate Grumke, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains, including WPR. This is Wisconsin Today.
Women's basketball is soaring to new popularity at the college and pro levels, led by the ascent of stars like Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese.
Their matchup last week between the Indiana Fever and Chicago Sky in the WNBA drew higher ratings than any Major League Baseball game this season and matched the viewership of average primetime NBA games.
Coaches in Wisconsin hope the interest in the sport at the top will have a trickle-down effect to youth levels, where participation in high school girls basketball has decreased a quarter over the past 15 years. Lisa Van Wyk is president and founder of Blaze Sports and Fitness and director of the Wisconsin Blaze, an AAU basketball and volleyball program based out of Appleton. It's in the middle of its 2025 season now. Lisa, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
What have you seen over the past bunch of years when it comes to trends in girls at various ages being interested in trying out basketball?
I believe that there definitely has been a rise in our youth girls basketball landscape, where I would say there are more elementary girls trying basketball for the first time more than ever.
I want to put a time frame on that. Are you talking this last couple of years when there's been so much attention on college women, Caitlin Clark, for example, and the WNBA? Is that something that you've seen generate more interest?
I've seen a little bit more, yes. So, for example, our AAU, Wisconsin Blaze AAU program that we run here in Appleton, Wisconsin, for the first time, we've actually had a full 10U or what would be considered fourth grade girls basketball team, and we could have had two. I know that there have been some other 10U teams and other programs across the state, but I've seen more of interest now in the last couple years, yes.
Now, when you hear from those kids, that 10-year-old and their families, what are they talking about when they say why they're checking out the basketball program?
I don't think that they say specifically it's because of the WNBA. I think overall, the focus on women's basketball college, WNBA, but also having more opportunity at their youth club programs and seeing the girls in their high school programs play and attending those games get them excited to participate.
Now, before this recent interest, we'd seen at least some reporting for high school programs now that they'd seen a gradual decline in girls going into basketball, in part because of competition from other sports. On the long view, have you seen ups and downs over the years?
I would definitely say that there has been a decrease or a decline in participation of girls' basketball, more at the high school level. From eighth grade and on, I've seen over the years, and I've been coaching for 30 years now, especially in our area, that we've had some struggles having enough players for three high school teams to get a freshman team and a JV and a varsity team. And honestly, I haven't seen a change in that. It hasn't gone in a positive direction because of the competition with volleyball, especially club volleyball that tends to run during the basketball season. That does definitely impact numbers. I've seen girls who've started or who have played basketball through their middle school years decide to just focus on volleyball. So it takes, I would say, even though that there's an increase in participation at the youth level in girls basketball in elementary, it seems to be the same in high school because it is such a competitive sport, very physical, time intensive in order to be a very impactful player that it's still tough to get the right type of kids competing at a high level in a number of them.
Well, it's interesting hearing you say that because I was wondering, you know, there's a bad news or a good news story here. The bad news might be, well, fewer girls are going into sports at all, and basketball is part of that story. Or it could be there's more options for girls in sports, and that might be siphoning some away from basketball. But overall, that might be a good thing. How do you see that all shaking out?
Yeah, you know, for me, I've coached so many kids, girls, boys, both youth and collegiate, over the years. And I always say, like, you have to do what you're passionate about. And so when we have kids in our program who start off in basketball and decide to go in another direction, for me, I love it because it's a sign that they're discovering who they are, and we support them in that. And yes, we've had some more competition in terms of we've seen girls go towards the hockey direction, lacrosse. There's a number of soccer players who also play basketball, but when we see them choose different sports, we're just happy that they're being active and they're finding what their passion is.
There's been some concern about specialization, maybe over-specialization for athletes, boys and girls for that matter, starting at 5 or 8 or 10 or whatever, sticking with the same sport through high school, maybe into college. What's the case for making it more possible to do more sports for that kid, to not specialize, to be a generalist in athletics?
I think all kids should try different sports when they're youth. 5 years old through 8, through 10, 11, 12, middle school years. Let them try different things. Let them find what they're passionate about. As parents, as coaches, try to support them in that journey because you really don't want to force them and pinhole them into something you think they should do. It should be something that they fall in love with because in the end, they will be passionate about it. They'll be more committed to it. They'll succeed more in it. I would say in terms of locking in and focusing more on a sport or two sports, I think they should start to think about that by the time they're a freshman. I see a lot of kids who, if they try to do too many sports at least at one time, they get burned out and overtaxed. Then they start facing injuries, unfortunately. And so if they know that they, let's say those players who are freshman, sophomore, know they want to play basketball in college and they have to put additional time out of our team practices in. They have to spend individual time in the gym in order to compete nationally. It tends to be too much.
We are talking about girls basketball in Wisconsin. Lisa Van Wyk is with us, president and founder of Blaze Sports and Fitness, director for the Wisconsin Blaze. That's an AAU basketball program. They're based out of Appleton. Lisa, it sounds like you're a booster for being involved in athletics in general. And I know at Blaze you do basketball and volleyball. Forget all those other sports for a minute. Make the case that, hey, girls should consider at least giving a try for basketball at some point in their sports career.
Oh, absolutely. I would say basketball is probably one of the premier sports that would help you develop your physical stamina, your grit, your ability to focus and just keen in on your ability to think at a higher level. There's so much to the game that I'm still learning that challenges you both physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, as a communicator, as a leader. There's just so much to the sport that helps an athlete become truly not only just great at the sport, but just a great person overall. So I love now what I run volleyball, club volleyball at Wisconsin Blaze. We have a volleyball director here. I established that a dozen years ago, back in 2013. But, and I'll never say, oh, don't play volleyball, because my volleyball director would probably not like that. We love volleyball here. But I do have to say, I think it's basketball is a very challenging sport. So if you're a person who loves an ultimate challenge, because you're running up and down that court, it's a contact sport. There's a lot to the game that has to be learned. Like, it's a huge challenge. And I think if somebody's looking to be challenged, basketball would be a tremendous sport to participate in.
Now, bringing things back around, we've got this, what seems to be a moment, more than a moment, for women's basketball. Angel Reese, Caitlin Clark getting a lot of attention. We've seen, I've talked on the air in the past about, you know, girls' soccer getting a big boost from Women's World Cup victories, things like that. What do you think needs to happen for clubs, for school programs to harness this high-level popularity of the WNBA and bring it to that youth level of the sport?
I think we should have a WNBA professional team here in Wisconsin, and I should run it. So, yeah, that's what
but
I think.
But until then.
Until then, I really think that families should spend time, not only together, but spend time watching the sport on TV, and then take a time where you go as a family to go watch a game live. I had the opportunity to go and watch Caitlin Clark last year, her first season at Indiana, and watch the Indiana Fever, and was able to take our girls from our basketball team to watch them as well. And it's inspiring. It's really cool because they're right there. You can almost touch them, and you can analyze their gameplay and see, oh, some of the things we're doing, they're doing. And it's really cool to just make that connection. And it's neat for these young athletes to just realize that they're just everyday people, and that's who they used to be, with a little girl like them. And it's possible for any of them to, if they really want it and they work for it, to get to that point.
Lisa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lisa Van Wyk is president and founder of Blaze Sports and Fitness, director for the Wisconsin Blaze, an AAU basketball program based out of Appleton. She was with us today to look at recent declines in girls' high school basketball participation in Wisconsin and whether the popularity of professional women's basketball could build more interest at the youth levels. The Scripps National Spelling Bee marks its 100th anniversary this week.
And the finals take place tonight, just outside the nation's capital. Two 12-year-old competitors represented Wisconsin in the event from New Berlin and Appleton. They had a good run, but didn't make the finals. Hey, Rob, did you compete in spelling bees?
I did in elementary school. I was pretty good, but not anywhere near this kind of level. And then there's my big fiasco.
You can't leave us hanging. What happened?
So my dad had a job in Taylor, Michigan. T-A-Y-L-O-R.
Gotcha.
In a spelling bee, I got the word Taylor.
Taylor, T-A-I-L-O-R. Should have been easy, but I went with the city instead of the word, and I was out. On the upside, I bet a lot of Taylor Swift fans have been bounced out of spelling bees for the same reason.
Do you have a spelling bee memory to share? What was the furthest you ever got? What was the word that foiled your spelling bee dreams and aspirations? Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Trevor Hook, and Lauren Cox.
Our technical director is Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.